lost my mind.
It was my favorite part of the show. I agree. It was my favorite part of the show.
Like, I don't care what anyone says, it is the best part of the show.
It sounds perfect. I cannot wait for more people to hear it.
My jaw on the floor and remained there for the rest of the show. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Off to Broadway, the podcast where we deep dive into anything and everything musical theater from the comfort of my car. I'm Tara.
I'm Stefania.
And in today's episode, we're talking about the highly anticipated pre-Broadway and Juliet. I can't believe we've already seen this and we're recording it this early. Like, I can't believe it.
We're silly because we did see the first performance, the first public performance here in Toronto. There was an invited dress the night before. And then Wednesday, June 22nd, we were like, we must go.
Yeah, it wasn't like, it was kind of a maybe because we had seen Dixon Road the week before. Mm-hmm. And this is where we were talking about it happening. And for some reason, I thought first preview was like a Tuesday. Same. And then when we discovered that it was actually the Wednesday and that we were both free, we were like, I mean, what else are we doing on Wednesday?
We must go. I mean, let's talk about how we saw it. We bought rush tickets.
Yeah.
Mirvish has been recently, they've done it before, but it seems like for all productions now they're offering rush tickets. So they're $39 plus a $5 admin fee, unless you're
not a subscriber. Not for every performance, because Harry Potter, which maybe we shouldn't be giving this information because I don't know that many people know about.
And then you can expose the Harry Potter.
But there might be a Harry Potter rush right now. That one's $49. And then
and Two Jake Hands. And Jake Epstein was $29. So.
Yeah, and Two Hands, no, it's the other way around. Two Pianos, Four Hands, Four Hands, Two Pianos, whatever it's called, is also a $29 rush. So it's varying in
yes,
price.
But for Anne Juliet, it's $39 plus a $5 service fee, unless you're a subscriber, in which case you don't have to pay that $5 service fee. So Tara is like...
This was really exciting information to me when we figured this out.
Yeah. It was quite exciting. So that's how we saw it that first night. There's also a lottery offered that I have already won. so it doesn't seem like...
Date stamp this episode. It's currently June 28th. First preview was June 22nd, and Steph has already seen this show twice. And guess what? We're going again on July 7th, which by the time this episode comes out, it's open.
We're wearing our merch.
We are.
We're wearing our Du Bois Band merch.
We'll get into that later. It's a bit of a spoiler.
But if there is great budget ways to see this show. So we bought rush tickets and I also won lottery tickets and the tickets ended up in kind of the same space. So I would suggest rush over lottery because then you can choose where you sit.
Yeah.
And you have a little more control over that. Whereas you kind of just had to take what you get with lottery.
We didn't know, which I think is also part of the reason that you bought the lottery ticket, was that like you wanted to know where the seat was, but also your mom won the lottery that day. So
we both won the lottery. We only used one of our like wins.
I'm not sure who wasn't entering the Anne Juliet lottery for Saturday of Pride, but maybe that's why.
Maybe that's why the target audience was occupied. So they're like, anyone. Yeah. So they were kind of like rear side orchestra, which is kind of where the rush tickets end up being as well. So yeah. I would recommend rush over lottery. If they were front row.
Oh my God.
Absolutely would recommend that because I want to look into the eyes of every performer.
Yeah, we don't know where our media night tickets are, but we're hoping that they're pretty close.
I want to see their faces. I want them to see me scream.
Yeah. So as I said, much anticipated Anne Juliet, and this was announced in the 2020-2021 Mirvish season. It was supposed to be here in February of 2021, but obviously we know what happened. Yeah. And at that time, it was being marketed as the North American premiere. And since then, it has been marketed as pre-Broadway, which is so exciting. If you've listened to our podcast in the past, you know that any time that there's a pre-Broadway happening in Toronto, it's just like really exciting for the city. And I don't know, a show
what
like this.
Was the
this,
last time one we had? Like,
I think
Ain't
it was Ain't Too Proud. Yeah, it was Ain't Too Proud. I know.
And, the,
and
that
the time before that was Aladdin.
Aladdin, yeah. We get them ever so often. Yeah, I think when it was announced for that first run in 2021 that didn't end up happening, I think we suspected it was a pre-Broadway.
Yeah.
But to have that confirmation with this run is pretty exciting.
And rumor has it, and again, I don't know because we are recording this a few weeks earlier than the release date, but rumor has it a theater has been picked everything is chosen. This show is transferring. It's just a matter of when and where. So that information is to come. Maybe we'll have that information by the time we do our New York season preview, but we'll see what happens. Anyway, we have been so excited about Anne Juliet for what feels like forever, like almost 4 years, I want to say, because when it first opened on the West End, I want to say it's close to 4 years ago, maybe 2019 now.
I think it opened on the West End, so about three years.
And this was a cast recording that, like, as soon as I had seen maybe a trailer or something on Instagram or Twitter, was like, oh, I gotta listen to this cast recording because it's all pop music. And this was actually a show that I brought, like, as an obsession from 2019 into 2020. So to say that I was excited to see the show, I feel like, is the biggest understatement of the year. And to actually be in the room for first preview, I feel like the energy was there. I wish it was a little bit more, but the energy was there and the cast was giving like 150%. It was so much fun.
Yeah, typically, so we saw the first preview and that's kind of what we're reviewing. And typically we wouldn't necessarily review a first preview because things change before opening night. But because it's been running for a couple years in the West End, I believe it's probably pretty settled. They might tweak some jokes for cultural differences, would be my big guess. But I think, like, all the songs are going to stay the same. The structure is going to stay the same. It'll just be maybe a few lines here and there that'll change. And I think this cast is their plan to bring this entire cast to Broadway as well, which is really exciting.
Yeah. So for anybody that doesn't know what Anne Juliet is, warning now, this will be a spoiler, I don't want to say heavy episode, but it might be a spoiler heavy episode. So if you are planning to see the run of Anne Juliet in Toronto, go see it first and then come back and listen to this episode. But it is the story of what happens if Juliet didn't die. And I feel like that is pretty much like the most basic, but also tells you exactly what you need to know synopsis. Because even us who had listened to this cast recording for 3 years, I still didn't know what the storyline was until we sat in that theater.
Yeah, I'd read even a Wikipedia summary, and yet I was still taken by surprise by most of it. So it's what happens if Juliet didn't die, but set to the music of Max Martin. So it's basically pop music from kind of 1997 to 2016 is when I figured out the time period is. And so for us, that is kind of the exact time period of music that we grew up listening to. So we were going in already absolutely primed. That cast recording is so fun because it's songs we already love and know, and we have these emotional connections to these songs from listening to them as kids. I mean kids, as kids and growing up, and these are artists that, like, as a pop music lover, these are artists that I love to listen to. So then to see their songs being used to tell this new story was like, I don't know, I was very excited.
I mean, starting off your musical with Larger Than Life, I'm already out of my seat excited.
It actually, okay, so, but like, before we get into the show. Okay, so what we knew before we saw it was we knew that cast recording pretty well, both of us, I would say.
Yes, very well.
We listened to it a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, so what was our favorite moment on the cast recording before we saw it?
Okay, so I feel like if you were to ask me this question, I mean, if you asked me this question in 2019, which was my obsession going into 2020, it was Problem / Can't Feel My Face. She told me don't worry. I am obsessed with that mashup. I think it is so smart. I think on stage, which we'll get to that in a little bit, on stage it is like elevated to the next level. But I think that those two songs, I mean, an amazing Ariana Grande song, an amazing The Weeknd song, and when you put them together, it's just perfect. So if you were to ask me then, that is my number one. If you were to ask me, like, within the pandemic, what I listen to the most, it's Domino. I love Domino.
I Domino also, I was listening to it maybe a month or two ago, and I think I texted you being like, why does Domino go so hard?
It goes so hard, so hard. Oh, baby, baby, got me feeling so right. Yeah. Oh, baby, baby, dancing in the moonlight. Yeah. Oh, baby, baby, got me feeling so right. Baby, baby, baby. Ooh, 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 ooh. Rock my world into the sunlight. Make this dream the best I've ever known. Dirty dancing in the moonlight.
When I first listened to the cast recording, the song that I loved was It's My Life. Which is a big spoiler for the show, but It's My Life was just my favorite. And then I agree, Domino, really great.
There was one day. There was one day I was driving to work and I just had like all of my downloaded songs on shuffle and Domino came on and I was blasting it. I swear my volume was at the highest it's ever been. And I was like, wow, how could we forget about this like iconic Jessie J song? And you know what? In this
we never give the credit to Jessie J. Nobody gives Jessie J the credit. And I would like to, on this podcast, take the time to give Jessie J the credit for Domino.
No, it's true. It's for very bang, true. Bang. For
Price Tag.
Wow, Price Tag. I love the song Who You Are. It's a slow ballad, but love that song.
You're absolutely right.
And there's an original Jessie J song in Juliet, which is called One More Try. So, one more time, one more time. One more time?
I always thought it was called One More Try.
But I also thought it was One More Try.
Okay, so this is actually a call out to Mervish. The program song listings has a couple of mistakes in it. I believe it's called One More Try. That song should be before Problem I Can't Feel My Face.
How dare they disrespect Jessie J like this? It's called One More Try, not One More Time. I feel like the mistake is because Baby One More Time is also in this show. So
someone was typing and they were not paying attention.
Yeah. And then I would say if we were to talk about, I feel like we're too soon here to go into songs that hit hardest during the show. So
that was kind of going to be my next thing. Like, so when you saw the show.
Yeah.
What was something that didn't necessarily stand out on the cast recording, but hit so much harder once you saw it on stage?
Show Me Love.
Show Me Love.
What? Why was that so good?
As a Robin stan, Dancing on My Own. Just
Dancing
all
on
Robin
My Own
songs.
Has been an obsession many times. I feel like, you know, Bridgerton really did it for us with Dancing on My Own this season.
Honestly,
so
all Robin songs, Body Talk, Part 1, Part 2, just all of that. But this is kind of very early Robin, Show Me Love, and Show Me Love.
Show Me Love. It hits so hard on stage.
Baby, show me what it's all about.
All right.
You're the one that I
ever needed. Also, apologies in advance for all of the singing and screaming we might be doing on this episode because we're excited.
These are songs you know. This is a bit of an aside, but so the second time I saw it, I took my parents with me. And I kept telling them, it's the music of Max Martin. It's the music of Max Martin. I don't think they knew who that was.
Yeah, my parents didn't know who that was either when I told them about this.
So then at intermission, because we were sitting in separate spots, I went to them. I was like, what do you guys think? Mom's like, oh, it's all music we know. And I was like, I was trying to tell you this.
Unless you spell out what the songs actually are, the music of Max Martin means nothing.
No, I know.
Which is kind of interesting because even this man has made 1 million songs. Like, we were just going through his entire, song list. He's done so many bangers, and every single song in this musical is a banger, but to think that, like, there are so many more that he's done, I feel like we were learning stuff 5 minutes ago for the first time, so.
Yeah, absolutely. Show Me Love was a song that we found was kind of, I don't know, not a skip on the cast recording, but it didn't stand out. But seeing it sung so wonderfully and kind of even the staging of it is really fun. Like, it's quite simple. I think that's the moment where they reveal the double turntable as well.
Oh my God. Sorry, we need to stop what we're doing right now and talk about the double turntable. I have seen many shows. I have seen many shows with turntables. Never in my life have I seen a double turntable that rises, and while they are up in the air, one is spinning and then the other one is spinning the other way.
It was so fun. It was so much fun.
I was losing my mind over the mechanics of that. And while we're here, I just want to talk about the one disappointing thing to me in this production. And it's no fault to, you know, Max Martin, or we haven't even said who is the book writer of this musical, who's Canadian, David West Reed. He's done work on Schitt's Creek, so that's what he's most known for. Actually, the
number one advertisement in Canada from the writer of Schitt's Creek. Dan Levy? No, another man.
That's exactly. So this has nothing to do with them. I mean, maybe they had some say, but not enough. What's with the projections, guys? And I feel like if you've listened to us since the beginning of this podcast, you'll know I hate a projection. And I really hate a projection when it's using stock images on a background that big. And we got that many times in this show.
Some of the projections I really didn't mind. And I'm not a projection hater in the way that you are. I think that they can work, and I think they can show things that are hard, and I think they're a good budget option. It's only there's only a screen on the top half of the stage. It's not on the bottom half of the stage. But there were some moments that were a little cringeworthy for the projections. I would say 75% I had zero problem with, and then 25% were a little ooh for me.
But the ones that were bad. Like,
you're talking almost about as the carousel. Bad as like
I'm talking about the carousel, but it made me think of, which also made me think of the last time that we were together in the Princess of Wales was for Summer, a Donna Summer musical, and it made me think of the lipstick projection.
It wasn't that bad. It wasn't that bad as the lipstick projection in Summer, a Donna Summer. Don't do that. Don't say that.
But yeah, the carousel was the one I really hated the most because it was actually like, go to iStock.com, look up carousel and download it and put it on a screen.
You know, like 75% of them I was fine with. Sometimes they would like put up a location, tell us where we were.
Yeah, I like that.
We'd be following a map. I liked it when it was a bit more
subtle.
Yeah, not even subtle, but almost like less subtle. Like when it was not just being a background, when it was kind of explaining things and it was being very stylistic versus when it was, let's say, like the carousel Ferris wheel moment, where it was just trying to be like a pretty background for something. That was kind of, I liked when they were playing with, I don't know, extending the set using it. Like there's a moment where there's balloons on stage.
That was great. And
the balloons extend through the projection, which was really fun. Or, you know, because of the way that the story is structured, you have Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway kind of writing and not writing, like, and kind of jumping in and out of the story, and sometimes it'd be like lights up and like the screen would almost, the light would hit through it and you'd see the back of the stage, the back wall. And I like the way they use that screen there. But yeah, there were like a few that were just a little bit clunky.
I feel like my main issue with that, and I'm gonna bring in a show that I think is very similar, also a jukebox, does it so much better, and it's Moulin Rouge. And when you see...
No projections, really, on that show.
I mean, that practical set is out of this world. It is gorgeous. Like, if you have not seen a photo from Moulin Rouge, where have you been?
But I laugh thinking about the Moulin Rouge Eiffel Tower and then the Anne Juliet Eiffel Tower. Like, the difference is just...
But also they have the little, like, Moulin Rouge.
The little windmill. Yeah, you're right.
The little windmill, yeah. So, in terms of, like, that, which I do think... that when this show does hit Broadway, there will be so many comparisons to Moulin Rouge because, again, it is this, it's jukebox musical, it's popular music. And so as a direct comparison, like the sets are not even comparable in my mind.
No, yeah. Absolutely not.
But Moulin Rouge doesn't have a double turntable that lifts, so.
Yeah, there is no turn. But I'm thinking about that elephant love medley moment where the entire elephant turns around.
I know.
Amazing.
I know.
Amazing.
And also thinking about like Shut Up and Dance, Raise a Glass.
The
diamond, like they move it.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They do the turntable without a turntable. But
Well, even thinking about in like Backstage Romance, where like the stage like rises and then it goes back down and then rises again. Like there's like steps. There's like a stage on stage. You know, the Moulin Rouge stage is doing things. It's doing some stuff.
They're doing so much. But I just love that like... a show like this, I mean, I assume the turntable existed at Princess of Wales before, but I could be wrong.
Because it's an out of town, you know, they have a bit more of a budget versus a tour, which is what we normally see at the Princess of Wales. They have a bit more of a budget to really make the stage into what they are going to make it to on Broadway. So right. I think, you know, that double turntable with a lift, the trap door at the front of the stage, you know, these are things that there's like pyro at certain moments. Like they spent that money, they renovated, not renovated the theater, but they adapted it to what they needed and they had the budget to do it because it's part of the development process of bringing it to Broadway.
Yeah, they're not. It's not the same budget as Cursed Child over at the
Edinburgh Theater. What is the same budget as Cursed Child?
But you know, there's a trap door here too, so it's all the same. It's all relative. But
I watched with my parents, and they were saying they got stressed every time the trap door was open that someone was gonna fall through. I feel like when it's open and they're like nothing.
Sometimes
going on
I feel yet. That way too, and I like. But that's the thing. Like this is me being nerdy about it, but like I like to watch how Same. Close they get.
Seeing it a second time, I knew when the trapdoor would be opening and when it would be.
Yeah.
I was like waiting for it to open to get ready for someone's entrance for a certain thing.
When Romeo's coffin rises up, you know.
certain moments, very exciting. So like on a second time, you're like, okay, oh, she's standing right on top of it, but it's got to go down soon to get ready for this next moment. You know?
Yeah.
She's right there. Do they know? Anyway, yeah, it's interesting. So because this is the pre-Broadway, let's talk about this cast.
Okay. Let's start with the two that we know of, because Betsy Wolfe and Stark Sands are in this cast, and I feel like as soon as the two of them were announced, we were like, okay, this is made to transfer. Like, why Absolutely. Would they cast them the if they weren't cast. Making this to transfer? Mm-hmm. We have seen Betsy Wolfe perform at Roy Thomson Hall with Jeremy Jordan. There's a very blurry picture of Steph, Betsy, and I, which I will put on the screen now. And we have never seen Stark Sands perform, but you better believe that I have watched him sing Soul of a Man every single day for maybe the last, like, 10 years.
As someone who loves the American Idiot cast recording, this was really thrilling to me. He's done a lot of, not necessarily jukebox, but, like, American Idiot's jukebox, Kinky Boots is written by Cyndi Lauper, so written by a pop star.
And, yeah, totally. You
know, he did that Avett Brothers musical, so he's just singing all this other people's music.
And we talked about this when we saw the show. We don't know why we're so obsessed with Stark Sands, but we are.
He's wonderful in it. And I feel like it's not out of character, but I feel
it's out of character.
I feel like it's a little bit. I think of him as a little more of a serious person.
Same, and I don't know why.
And yeah, me neither, because like we don't know him. But I think of him as a bit more of a serious person. But he's very much playing like a Christian Borle something rotten version of Shakespeare in this show, and it's very funny.
Very funny. He's got some really good like lines direct to the audience, which is great. And he sounds better than ever. He is like singing for his life up there. Sounds... You know, he opens the show, which is like so, so exciting. But I don't like, can we reveal the moment?
When he comes up from the trap door? Is
that no. what No. Can we reveal the moment?
The Du Bois band?
We won't reveal who is in Du Bois band. But when Stark Sands and the other men on stage, won't reveal who they are, start singing Everybody, as in like Backstreet's Back, I lost my mind. Everybody, rock your body. Everybody, rock your body right. The boy band's back.
It was my favorite part of the show. I agree.
It is the best part of the show. Like, I don't care what anyone says, it is the best part of the show. So
it's so funny. It's not long enough. It should be longer.
No.
It's so funny.
I have not bought a theater shirt since I saw Hamilton, and the way that we both needed this t-shirt really says it all. Really says it all. So that's Stark Sands' performance, and then his counterpart, Betsy Wolfe, playing Anne Hathaway. I mean, we knew that she was going to be amazing in this. And The video that stands out to me is when she posted on Instagram and on TikTok her singing the teeniest, tiniest snippet of One More Try, which is a song that she doesn't even sing in this show. Mm-hmm. And we both messaged each other being like, oh, this is going to be really good. This music sits in her sweet spot vocally.
Ooh, we all were born to break the rules. But now I've got a ladder here to climb. But on this starry night, I'm feeling ooh. Oh, anything goes. This is the moment I've waited for.
And when she sings the greatest Celine Dion, I mean, it's not the greatest Celine Dion song, but like one of the greatest Celine Dion songs. That's the way it is.
That's the way it is.
The mid-song ovation that was given on a first preview, like, what more could I want?
She really just comes to the front of the stage and just like belts her heart out.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. Like, the audience is just so there for her. This is the moment when I cry in the show, when she sings That's the Way It Is. That's the way. Yeah, she hits these notes. She sounds so good. Like, she's in the prime vocally.
Yes.
And it sounds perfect. I cannot wait for more people to hear it.
And also, she's really funny in this. Like, she's got some really funny lines. Right off the top of the show, she's got a really funny line. And
my parents, Anne Hathaway was their favorite character or their favorite part of the show.
Interesting. And I said to you at intermission, I was like, I know that this show won a few Oliviers. I wasn't sure what they won. It turns out that featured actress was an Olivier that they won. Yeah. And just seeing her be on stage and like doing her thing, like, she is already campaigning for that Tony Award whenever the show transfers. So, and you know what? I'm behind it. I'm ready.
She's truly wonderful. So you have these kind of, even though the show is called Anne Juliet, and Juliet is, I would say, the main character, I think the leaders of the show are Shakespeare and Anne.
They're kind of narrating.
The one, yeah, exactly. They're guiding the audience through. They're talking directly to the audience a lot of the time too. And then other supporting characters, I think we got to talk about the nurse, and we got to talk about Lance. So Paolo Sazzat, world-renowned opera singer, Tony Award winner, Paolo Sazzat. Every time he was on stage, I was just like, Tony Award winner, Paolo Sazzat. Because he's also killing me in this show.
I have not seen him in anything, and haven't even seen like a YouTube video, nothing, but he is giving such an out-of-character performance in this.
He's so funny.
And nailing it.
He just cracks me up. There's a moment late where someone's like, no, we're not doing accents. And he's like, we're not. it just kind of encapsulates everything. Dream Break Free. And then the actress playing the nurse is Melanie LaBerry, who was the original West End nurse and is the one on the cast recording.
Which we didn't realize until after the show.
Oh, like, she sounds exactly the same. That's crazy.
Same person. So that's exciting that there was one UK transfer. And yeah. if she does transfer with the show to Broadway, it will be interesting. The one, unfortunately, we don't actually know what's going to happen, but Kiala Settle went in to play Nurse in the West End. Yeah. And I do think that it's very possible that she could be the nurse on Broadway. She's kind of a name player. It would make sense. So we'll have to see what happens there.
I agree. I think that's definitely a possibility. But I do wonder what kind of contracts they signed.
Yes.
When they signed on for the pre-Broadway, if they're like guaranteed Broadway. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But yeah, I can definitely see them replacing with Kiala or bringing her in for like some publicity.
And then before we get to Juliet, because that's a whole section of itself, but we also have a couple other side characters. We have Justin David Sullivan, who's playing May, which is, I want to say, a non-gendered character in this show. There is a queer relationship, and that is with Francois, who's played by Philip Arroyo?
Arroyo, I would say Arroyo.
Arroyo?
Yeah, Philippe Arroyo is how I would say
when he started singing, I was like, oh, this voice. Like, there are so many people that I was like, oh my God, these vocals. Like, everyone is top tier. And then before we get to the next two, we have to talk about friend of the podcast, Brandon Antonio. Like, I'm so excited for him. Every time, I feel like we've said this on many episodes in the last year, but when we found out he was transferring, one, super excited. Then when we found out we were in a first preview, it was like, oh my God, like Brandon on a big Toronto stage, yeah. Which we know he did Off Mervish Next to Normal. We saw him in that. We talked to him about that. Mm-hmm. But there's something about like main season that is just main season.
This is a big deal.
And then to know that this is heading to Broadway with potentially the full cast, and he could be making his Broadway debut. And if no one follows Brandon on Instagram or TikTok or whatever, you won't know that he is like the biggest Britney Spears fan of all time. And to think that he is, I want to say, like in a dream show right now,
it's a great just, match. Like,
so
of, like,
exciting
person to show, like performer to show. I think he like really suits it. Even, you know, in the ensemble, they're in these kind of like modern Renaissance like outfits, yeah. And we're like, oh, he's dressed like himself, you know?
Yeah, I swear I saw him on Instagram wearing like the exact same outfit,
the exact same crop top, you know?
Yeah. That's so if you're looking for Brandon, he's the one that's got like the 8-pack on stage. And
can I tell you how my parents described him?
Yeah,
because they knew he'd been on the podcast. And I told them, oh, someone who we've had on the podcast is in the show, and they were sitting separate from me. And intermission, my mom's like, the one you had on the podcast, is he the one with the thighs? And I'm like, yes, exactly. Yes, you've nailed it.
Yeah. So super exciting to see him in this. And Brandon also understudies Romeo and Francois. And you better believe that when he's on, we will be buying Rush tickets to see him again. And you know, we'll definitely be going to see the show on Broadway too. So Brandon will be there to see it as well. Our next two characters, and without giving anything away, we have to shout out Ben Jackson Walker, who's playing Romeo, because won't say who sings this song. You've already mentioned the song, but there is a moment in this show that is like so iconic, and I just love the way that Romeo has been made into a dumb boy. It's like my favorite thing.
It's really funny. The characterization of Romeo in Anne Juliet is quite amusing. And I like that, you know, when you think of Romeo and Juliet, you look at these characters from one perspective, and then this can give you like a whole entire new context on looking at these characters.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see, oh, maybe this was dumb, or maybe they shouldn't have done this. And you can kind of like, I don't know, a new perspective.
Yeah. And then, of course, we cannot forget about Juliet herself. Lorna Courtney. I just need to say, I don't think I've ever seen talent like that on a Mervish stage, maybe ever. She's so young, first of all, which is like so exciting that she is that young and that good. And when she opened her mouth and sang the first two sentences of Baby One More Time, my jaw on the floor and remained there for the rest of the show.
She was a star. You know, basically an unknown. We had, I guess, seen her in the 2020 West Side Story, may it rest in peace, but, you know, in the ensemble, so we didn't, like, point her out.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, the first, Juliet's first entrance, and she sings those lines, and I was immediately in on her. I'm like, she's good. She's great. And then
song, she kept one-upping herself every mm-hmm. single song. Like, I'm trying to think of, just looking at the song list, the moments that I was like, okay, vocals, obviously Baby One More Time, Confident,
mm-hmm.
crazy, and then I want to say in, like, Act Two, her portion of Problem, really good stuff, One More Try, beautiful.
Yep.
Both people sounded amazing singing that song. And then I would say when we get from like Stronger to Perfect to Roar, you're like, how are you even sustaining these three songs back to back to back?
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Yeah, this cast is wonderful. The entire ensemble is working really hard. Other people I want to shout out, there's kind of a couple of like hip hop poppers that I yeah. noticed in the ensemble. So Bobby Pocket Horner and Virgil Gadsden, and there's a little bit of a pre-show, and both of them are dancing a lot in the pre-show. And I like that they brought this kind of like hip hop movement into the show. It kind of like lets you in on the language. You know, it's not going to be Renaissance dancing. It's going to be pop modern dancing. I mean, maybe is this the time to talk about the choreography? Because I've heard like mixed reviews on the choreography, and I think it works. And the reason why I think it works is because it reminds me of pop star backup dancing. It reminds me of something Dua Lipa's backup dancers would be doing, which I think works in the context of all these pop songs. It's quite simple choreography, a little bit like, I describe it almost as like jazz funk, which is a silly term, but that's kind of what I would describe it as. And it's quite simple. We were Instagram DMing with Brandon and he said, I've got my dancing shoes on. And I'm like, you do, because there is a lot of dancing, but it's not like no one's doing a leg extension. It's not complicated. It's not crazy dancing. It's quite like simple, like isolated movements, a lot of repetition of the same movements over and over again, which I think mimics pop music and mimics backup dancers, which is why I think it works. But other people's critiques, like very simple, like quite rudimentary.
Yes. And I do think, again, to compare this to a Moulin Rouge, that dancing...
There's no comparison. Sorry for the dancing. There's no comparison.
It's like next level. So to think of like that, if you're thinking of, you know, dance to popular music and you're looking for a super dance heavy show, oh my God, go see Moulin Rouge. I'm also fine with it. I think another show that I do think this is going to get compared to a lot is Six. I think it is kind of similar to Six's choreography, which I also think is pretty simple. But I do think it might work a little bit better for Six than it did. I wanted more. I just wanted a bit more. Sure. I loved what they did with Problem Can't Feel My Face. Yeah. Loved
that's,
that.
I think, the highlight choreography moment.
Yeah. And you can see that there's like performances on YouTube from, I think it was Strictly Ballroom that they, they did it. And then they've recently did it on like West End Live. So you can see like a little bit of that.
Don't but, listen to it though. Cause,
everyone that performs at West End Live, I feel so bad for them because the sound system is just terrible.
It's really hard to mix would be my guess.
Like figure it out, West End Live. Trafalgar Square is not that big. Like we can figure this out.
Maybe they should just be... Lips
inside or that. So yeah, I would say like, I don't think it's the worst choreography I've ever seen, but I think there are moments when I'm like, oh, we could get more. But the ones that stood out to me, Blow, which we haven't even talked about. Blow.
This place about to blow.
Literally, as we sat in the theater, we knew it was coming and we turned to each other. We're like, this place is about to blow. And it did.
It actually did blow, which is crazy.
It did. So that really worked for me. And then Problem Can't Feel My Face, like, really worked for me choreo-wise.
Yes. I'm looking in the...
And obviously everybody choreo worked for me there,
too. Oh, yeah, absolutely. We participated.
Throw your hands up in the air. If you're in the audience and you're not participating in everybody, leave.
Yeah. I think it's in Roar, but there's, like, a little choreography movement that's, like, they're doing like a leg, and I was like, I like this. I'm into that. And it's Juliet. She's just doing it, and then more and more people join in, and it's like quite simple. And I was like, I think this has impact. Yeah, it's not. I'm not like
it's not groundbreaking. You just
see the choreography of the show. You don't, but I think it serves the purpose.
But it's interesting because I was talking to another friend of the podcast, Jared, who saw the show also on previews. He hated the choreography. And he said that it was hard for him because, like, everyone loves these songs. So you're already walking in knowing, like, love the music. That's not an issue. The music is definitely not an issue. He thought the book was okay. Sure. And because he thought the book was okay and he didn't really, like, connect with the characters, he was hoping that the choreography would, like, blow it out of the water. And because it didn't, it was, like, kind of difficult to, I don't know, feel as much as we felt, I guess.
Like, I do... do you want to talk about the book? Let's talk about the book.
Let's talk about the book.
This is the thing. The book is fine. It is what it is.
It is fine. It is mediocre. It's maybe what some might call weak. But you know what? It's not that deep, guys. It's really
this
not.
This is the number one answer. It is not that deep. It's just supposed to be a fun time. Okay, let's talk about the feminism of Anne Juliet. Let's talk about the feminism of Anne Juliet. Because I think that's like the number one thing where it's not that deep.
100%. I do think it's very, and not to get like serious on this for a second, but we are living in a time that is absolutely insane. And what's happened in the US in the last couple weeks is like the most horrific thing ever. So I feel like it's very difficult to not place any sort of feminism topics and like think about that. So yes. I think it's interesting that the show is coming out at this time. I know it already existed and I know mm-hmm. that these issues have been around Absolutely. Forever, but I do think it's interesting that this is coming out now. I agree that this written feminism is not that deep. I don't think it's meant to be taken any more than surface level, the lines that they're giving.
There's no nuance to it at all. No. It's very simple. But here's what I think. So the climactic moment is Juliet singing the song Roar by Katy Perry. And that song is also not that deep. It's a very surface level feminism. You know, and it's a fun song. It's a great song. You're going to hear me roar. It's a girl power anthem, but it's not that deep. And when your climactic moment is her singing, you're going to hear me roar. Like, I don't know how you, like, how intricate you want us to get to that climactic moment, you know?
No, I mean, if you're writing a storyline like this and you're writing all new original music, fine, right? Mm-hmm. Write the groundbreaking lyrics you want, but the song is already here for us and we're working within the parameters of the song. I think you can say the same argument for, again, Moulin Rouge. You know, Firework doesn't really fit in that show.
Always a Katy Perry song given that girl power anthem, okay?
But it's the same sort of thing of like, okay, like, do you ever feel like a plastic bag? No.
And yes,
no
I one do, actually. I do actually sometimes feel like a plastic bag drifting through the wind, wanting to start again. I think we can also say the same thing as Six.
I was going to say, Don't Need Your Love is a perfect, perfect example of that.
It's a very simplistic version of feminism. There are a lot of women of color, and even the star of Anne Juliet, typically a woman of color, but it's very much like white feminism as well. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not solving anything. We're not even saying really anything that people don't already know. It's just fun.
Yeah, I agree. Just fun. Surface level feminism, that's fine. I just think we might be heading into a place in theater in general that it's like, this is the only topic that we care about right now. And I don't know that I'm interested in that. Mm. I feel like it does feel a little bit recycled, especially because Six is right there for us. It's
sure.
Like
and
right
I do
there.
Think Six does it slightly better.
I agree. Yeah.
Maybe because it is original music.
Maybe.
And I think there is something too, and this and Six, and even Moulin Rouge does it to a little slightly lesser extent, but using pop music to talk about the issues that women were having 200 years ago, 300 years ago, 400 years ago, and having that be because pop music is a female-dominated genre and is one of mm-hmm. the only music genres that's like primarily female-dominated, even though, you know, Max Martin is a man, but the performers are women. And so we're taking this female-dominated art form from modern times and kind of using it to tell these historical stories and giving women a voice with this modern art form. And so both of these shows are kind of doing that. I do think Six does it slightly more successfully.
Yeah.
But this is very fun too. Like, there's nothing wrong with it, but if you're looking for like a really deep examination of feminism or you're asking it to make like bold statements, you've just come to the wrong place. Yeah. You're at the, go somewhere else. Don't even go to Six. Go somewhere completely else because you're not going to get it.
And then on the same vein, technically a jukebox musical, obviously the book has nothing to do with anything, but like Jagged Little Pill is a show that we had talked about. And to me, they did it the worst of all of them because they said, here's this issue, here's this issue, here's this issue, and maybe this one, and let's put it all in one show and only dive into them slightly and not do anything else.
It was too
Meanwhile,
much.
This show wins Best Book at the Tony Awards like last year, and I'm scratching my head wondering why.
Yeah, that was a choice. I mean, I guess the other option was like, I thought they were going to give it to Tina is the actual answer. Because Moulin Rouge, they couldn't give it to either. Really.
No, but I do think that, like, if we're talking about books of a jukebox, I don't think Moulin Rouge is bad. I also don't think Anne Juliet's is bad, but it's just,
it is what it is.
It is what it is. Yeah, it is what it is.
Like, this is, after we walked out, what I thought about Anne Juliet was that it picked a tone. It picked,
It picked
a style. And everything that they put in that show visually, sound wise, casting wise, everything, it fits that style so well. And if you don't like that, then the show is not for you. But they've committed so hard to this. I can't even describe it properly, but it's like, it's anachronistic, like modern, almost like queer.
Yes.
Kind of, you know, we're talking about like Brandon in the crop tops and the shorts, you know, when they're singing Blow, it feels
the
like
love story.
Like a gay nightclub. Yes. The like love story between a man and a non-binary person. Yeah, like the costumes, like the men in corsets and
yeah,
it's just it like they've picked a visual style. I can picture the vision boards, like the mood boards for the show so well.
It's like hot pink and yellow, and then yes, everything exactly. else like, around
the
it.
The neon signs. They've created such like a firm mood board, vision board for it, and everything like works so well with it. Yeah. And they nailed their vision, I think. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there was room for in their vision for this, like, I don't know,
out of this world book.
No,
I do think. And I don't think it's going to change. I don't think it's going to change.
If they're running in the West End for 2 years,
they might like drop or add a joke or two, but that's it. Yeah. The only thing I would say, though, is that, and I think this is something that is, like, decently frustrating because the show is supposed to be, like, about a feminist. It's written by a man. So, you know.
What else is new? Okay.
So that's, like, if you're going to be frustrated about something, I feel like that is the thing, not the entirety of this show.
Right.
Yeah. And then just to go on costumes for a second, we both decided that we need like high white socks and maybe Air Force Ones. So
I was really into the socks.
I know, same. I loved it. I loved the short skirt. The corset like dresses with mm-hmm. the like a little bit of a tulle skirt with mm-hmm. a high sock and an Air Force One. Like, wow, yes. I'm ready.
I agree. After I was like, well, I need the socks. I need to wear socks like that. Normally I'm like, pull them down. But no. Now I need them.
No.
Yeah. Like, I really like stage design, projections, whatever. Costumes, mm-hmm. great. Even like props, for the most part, I think were really fun.
Oh my God. We didn't even talk about my favorite, the chandelier. Like my favorite like set / prop, the bike. Stark's bike.
It's when the turntable's going.
I love that bike. Show me love. Also, just speaking about those practical sets, I love the Anne Juliet industrial set.
Yes.
That is the first picture I saw out of the West End. And as soon as we saw Mervish posted on Instagram that it was coming here, I was like, yes, we're getting the full experience.
It really sets the tone. Okay, so we talked a bit about the music, but we were going through Max Martin's song list of that he's written before, and we were like, okay, so I want to talk about, let's see, what's a song in the show that we think is like semi out of place, and what's a song that Max Martin has produced that we think we would add? I don't know where, but what mm-hmm. what we wanted to hear.
Okay, semi out of place. I think it's perfect, like Pink.
Yes, I don't disagree with you on that.
And I, again, have listened to that cast recording for, like, 3 years straight. And when I say 3 years straight, I mean literally 3 years straight. I've listened to it, like, almost every single day. And I knew that it was there, but it always just, forgot. Like, went over my head.
Absolutely yeah. forgot. A random one I'll say is What Do You Want From Me, which is a song I love. But it's very random, this Adam Lambert tune. I'll also say maybe the moment where the show drags the most for me is I'm Not a Girl, Not Yet a Woman. It really slows down at that moment. I feel like the show is at its best when we're getting big ensemble group numbers, and that really slows it down.
I mean, before we move on to like a song that would go in, talking about the musical numbers between Act 1 and Act 2, we agreed Act 2, like amazing. The flow of those songs, it's like, I know they're all hit after hit after hit, mm-hmm. but that act really feels like next one coming up. Oh my God, this one's so exciting. Oh my God, that one's so exciting. Like, it was a really good act two.
It's actually funny. My parents preferred act one to act two. They're like,
oh, really?
I'm like, okay. Because I remember us being like, act two nails it. I think the thing about act two is problem. I can't, well, since you've been gone, which is really funny. Problem. I can't feel my face. And you know, everybody Backstreet's back. And also that's the way it is. Sorry. We just listed half the other one. So I remember what I was going to say.
Okay.
When we saw Moulin Rouge in previews, something we remarked upon was the laughing when audiences realized what song they were about to sing.
Yes.
So it'd be this intense emotional moment in the show. Aaron Tveit is like on his knees and he's like, I remember when. And the audience loses it. Absolutely loses it. They think it's the funniest thing they've ever seen. And obviously that was a comedy moment. I will say,
when I saw it with my mom, which was, like, very close after it had opened on Broadway, lots of laughter again. But then when we saw it, I feel like no one was laughing by that point.
Probably, no. I feel like once the cast recording is out more, that happens a little bit less.
So I mean, also comedy firework, but that makes me laugh even still. So.
So the laughter that would happen, and I think happens often in a jukebox musical where the audience like has a bit of a realization.
They're like, oh, I know this song.
Yeah. They're like, I can't believe they're singing Crazy by Gnarls Barkley right now. Whereas in Anne Juliet, this happens a lot. The laughter happens a lot too, but it's on purpose. When Juliet sings, "Oops, I did it again."
I think I did it again.
That's funny, and it's meant to be funny. And I think they've kind of, in some ways, maybe solved the problem of jukebox musicals in that there's no way for it not to be funny, and they lean in.
Yes, I would.
Not every problem, but
this is a comedy before anything else, where I would say Moulin Rouge is a dramedy. Mm-hmm. It is a drama first. I mean, it's really, at the end of the day, that is a heartbreaking story.
It's a tragedy. It's actually a tragedy.
It's a tragedy, yeah.
It's a Greek tragedy because it's Orpheus and Eurydice, isn't it? Like, that's what it's based on.
Yeah, for sure. So, I think we were really put off the first time we saw it by the laughs, because it was like, again, like as you said, like Aaron is sobbing on stage, and here we are as a collective audience laughing at him. It feels wrong.
But that was also the greatest theatrical experience of our lives, but
I
go on.
We'll never forget that ever. That's what we wanted first preview of Anne Juliet to feel like, was that.
Yeah.
Like I will never forget sitting in that theater. Like, thinking about some of those moments, like, I can get chills right now just thinking about it. I think they sort of solved that as we went through, because even with us, like, was that a preview that we saw of Moulin Rouge?
Yeah, it was a preview.
Yeah, so that was an out-of-town preview. Yeah. So by the time it hit Broadway, they got rid of the, like, shake it off, everyone's laughing moment. That song was completely cut from the show, right? So they took things out of the show, and I feel like there are moments in Moulin Rouge where applause happens enough that they don't let you get your laughs out. So they kind of like figured it out that way. But I do agree, if you're looking for the blueprint of a jukebox musical comedy, this is it.
Yeah.
Because every song warrants the laughter, and the ones that don't. So they're doing it right.
There's kind of an inevitability, like it's just a natural reaction from the audience when they recognize the song to like laugh. And it doesn't break the momentum of this show, because you're supposed to. When she starts singing Since You've Been Gone, you know, she's like, here's the thing.
We started out friends.
And it's funny. Yeah. It's meant to be funny.
Another one too, Teenage Dream, Break Free. Like,
hilarious.
If you want it, take it. Like, it's funny.
That's another thing. I really felt that they split up the lyrics really well.
Like,
that they felt like dialogue a lot of the times. And maybe that's down to, like, the way Max Martin writes. But when you talk about, let's say, I Want It That Way, the way they split up the lyrics between Shakespeare
and Anne,
I think it really works as, like, a conversational song. I think they did so many things well with...
With
splitting up the lyrics, Something Since You've Been Gone, Teenage Dream, and Break Free, I think, as well. I think they did such a good job in splitting them up.
Okay, so back to songs of his that we would put in.
Okay.
There's so many. Okay, give us.
Okay, I think we're really missing a Taylor song here, because Max has worked with Taylor. And I think the answer is I Knew You Were Trouble. That's what I'm going to say.
I 100% agree. That is the Taylor song. And anyone that has seen the show knows the context of this story.
Exactly.
It is... perfection.
Juliet would just lay into him. I knew you were trouble when you walked in, so shame on me. Now I'm lying on the cold, hard ground.
Yeah.
Exactly.
A Max Martin song that I am obsessed with, and do I think that... I don't know where it would go in the show. I have no idea, but Bang Bang. And I said to you...
We don't give...
You know, we just
credit.
Get Juliet, Nurse, and April singing a trio for literally no reason, just to serve vocals. I'd be here for it.
I would say, like, replace Domino with Bang Bang, but you need Domino.
You need Domino, but Domino needs a little bit of work, so...
Right. The biggest criticism. Have we talked about how Domino sounded bad?
No, we haven't. And we don't know why, but we think we know why, but we also need to see it again to figure out if that's the true reason why.
Yes, because we first saw it was the first preview where, like, Domino sounded like a hot mess, but it's the first preview.
It was also a mess. Like, they were falling on stage.
They're climbing on a bed and someone fell. And we're like, it's a hot mess, but it's the first preview, so this is fixable. But then I saw it again, like, 3 days later. And it was a hot mess again. And...
Sorry, we didn't even talk about the fact that you saw an understudy.
You're right. I did not see Lorna Courtney the second time. I saw Rachel Webb, who was also amazing. Her shining moment, I think, was Roar. She really just, like, belted it out. And there's probably also a relief in that moment where you're,
oh, yeah, you're
at,
like,
the end.
I'm
you don't
done.
Have to save your voice anymore. So she can just scream. Yeah. Not scream, belt. Yes. So she really, like, got
well,
nailed
maybe
that.
Maybe Skrelt, you know, Skrelt. Just a bit
no,
of
she sounded great. She sounded really great. She was wonderful. I'm glad that I saw, like, a different Juliet to, like, kind of hear, like, a different interpretation, kind of see how the show works with someone else. But, yeah. So, yeah. So, the second time I saw it, Domino's still a mess. And I don't know if it's fixable now that I've seen it twice.
And we have nothing to compare it to because we only can compare it to the cast recording, which, as we had said at the beginning of this episode, one of my favorites mm-hmm. on the entire thing. But, like, I don't know how it sounds live in the West End either.
Absolutely.
So, like, there's a lot of movement going on. There's a lot of, like, mm-hmm. solos happening. And then it's the harmonies that it's a little messy.
Yes. And, you know, when two people are singing together, it's kind of easy to mix. And when it's a big ensemble, it's a little bit easier. But this is only four people singing. So it's almost, like, in
three.
The middle. No,
four.
Four people singing. And so it's almost in the middle. So you can hear each individual voice. And it sounds a little off. And I
this might be a sound mixing Mervish issue as well that we just don't know.
That's true, because I was sitting dead center the second time I saw it, and it still sounded bad. But my parents were sitting off to the side, and my dad was like, the sound mix is a little funky. And I'm like, well, because they're sound mixing it for the center, and it always sounds a little funky off to the sides.
Another thing we should mention, speaking of sound mix, and again, the only time that we had heard this was when we saw a Donna Summer musical, when the track happened, but there's some track happening in the show, and it works. There's, like, sound effects that go, and it's definitely, like, going around the theater, which is really fun.
I think the vivid memory is during One More Try, there's, like, a little bit of an echo.
Echo, yeah. Echo is used in a really... good way. Sometimes echo, you had said to me in Hamilton when echo is used, not in a great way.
Sometimes it sounds weird.
Yeah, but in this, it's like kind of like a magical moment. Everything that's happening on the stage is like kind of fantastical. So to have the echo like really works for that song. And then I also think of there were sound effects like at the beginning of Blow, which was exciting. You could hear things happening.
This
Blow was really
blow.
A good time.
This
I cannot wait
to
see Blow again. This place about to
Kesha. We forget.
Kesha.
We forget what Kesha has given us.
Yeah, it's true. Another song of his that I think could work in this show, specifically for the, like, love triangle that's happening, Quit Playing Games With My Heart.
Say, Quit Playing Games With My Heart. That's, like,
Quit
I think a May to Francois moment. Quit Playing Games With My Heart.
Yeah. Love it.
Quit Playing Games. Maybe instead of What Do You Want From Me. But we've already got so much Backstreet Boys.
We have so much Backstreet Boys. This is almost a Backstreet Boys jukebox musical, but it's not.
Backstreet Boys and Britney, because how many? Okay, one, two... Three of the first four songs are Backstreet Boys. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six Backstreet Boys songs. 5 Britney songs.
Okay.
So six Backstreet Boys, 5
almost
Britney.
Almost even. Yeah.
And then like 3 Katy Perry, and I think those are like the top artists. Our final
closing thoughts on this show and its transfer to Broadway. What do you think the success will be like?
Okay, we were talking about this because the major comparisons, as we talked about, are Moulin Rouge and Six. And I think both of those shows are more successful overall than Anne Juliet is. I mean, Six is a big party, but this is a party.
It's a party.
This is a party in a way that Moulin Rouge is also a party. They're all parties.
A bit different.
But Moulin Rouge is a little dark.
But it's also like, I mean, all three shows I would say you leave on like a high for sure. Moulin Rouge is like... to me, that show's on a completely different level than everything else.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. So when you have these two other shows on Broadway that are kind of doing what Anne Juliet is doing, but better.
I know.
I think we're not going to see huge longevity for Anne Juliet. But I do think it has the strength of a great song catalog. And I know people don't, you know, the Music Max Martin, not everyone's going to recognize what that means. So they need to be like pumping those songs in every ad. They need to be like playing Britney Spears in every ad. I just think what their advantage might be is that Six and Moulin Rouge have expensive, slightly harder to get tickets at this time. So Anne Juliet might kind of be the option when you haven't been able to get tickets, those other two. My prediction is that they're going to open in the spring, like March 2023, and they're going to run for 1 year. They're going to close in like January.
Okay. That's fair. I think it's interesting. I just realized, like, as you were talking, that Moulin Rouge 6 and Anne Juliet are all running at the same time in the West End right now.
That's true. That's absolutely true. And Anne Juliet has Moulin Rouge
is the newcomer because it just opened. Pandemic 6 obviously has been there.
6 and Anne Juliet are West End to Broadway transfers, and Moulin Rouge is a Broadway to West End transfer. So
yes, exactly. So that was an interesting. I don't know the grosses in the West End.
I don't know either. Another kind of interesting thing is that they're not doing British accents.
They're not, which I think is fine.
It's fine. I agree. Same with Six. We're already like playing with time periods and settings and whatever, it's fine. But yeah, just something to note. So I see it opening in the spring and then running maybe like a year-ish.
Yeah. My final thoughts are this is a straight up party. I literally cannot wait to see the show again. And then after we see it again, I can't wait to see it again. Like, that's how much of a party the show is and how much I enjoyed it. Again, as we said, not that deep, guys. So if you are looking for a deep musical about what happens to Juliet if she does not die, this is not it. Maybe go see the Fringe Festival show, because that might be it. The one that's playing that's also about what happens if Juliet doesn't die.
We're like, again? I think we've heard enough. We know.
But songs, banger after banger after banger.
Credit to Max Martin for just writing bangers. Bangers only.
Totally. And then, like, the performances. Betsy Wolff, Stark Sands, Lorna Courtney. I can't even believe. I'm so excited for her to be back on Broadway, but this time in, like, a leading role, because this is, it's such a demanding role. And I do think there will be a schedule for this, because, as we know, those songs, not sustainable 8 times a week. I don't even think Miriam Teakley is doing it, like, all the time in the West End. She's still there. She's been there forever, but she's not doing it every single show, because it's hard vocally. And I am interested to see what happens after opening night, because I don't know that this is for the subscriber audience, and I say that all the time. I think this is for us. It is for people that are younger than us, and then it's also for people that are just, like, obsessed with this music. I don't know, an interesting take on a Shakespeare. I think for that, it's so interesting because I feel like this show is literally made for us. It's pop music, and we're also interested on an interesting take of a Shakespeare. So whenever we see something that's like even a Hyde Park performance where they do, I think we were talking about this the other day, that like Romeo and Juliet was dueling soccer teams. Like, that's an interesting take on a Shakespeare. So
I love Romeo and Juliet in any form. For some reason, it hits every time. And this one hits too.
Yeah.
It's just a party.
Okay, what is your rating? This feels so foreign to me because we've never done it for an actual show.
We did it for movies, and I think it helps. I'm going to give it 4 out of 5 carriage driver hats.
Well, I'm never going to be able to find a picture of that. So sorry. It's not going to be on the screen. I also give it 4 out of 5... Ooh, what should my metric be? This is going to be, like, so basic, but a quill. 4 to 5 quills.
That's a good one.
Because it is a very important prop in this show.
Yes, it is. It really is. I love the way that they use the quill to, like, play with the storytelling.
So, that is our thoughts on Anne Juliet. Anne Juliet is running in Toronto until August 14th, so go get your tickets. And as we said at the beginning of this episode, there is rush for this show. There is lottery for this show. So there are ways to see this at a discounted price. We highly recommend it. And I'm excited to find out when it's going to be on Broadway, because that is the next step. So a lot of exciting stuff for the show, and I can't wait to see what happens with it. And with that being said, it's now time for our obsession of the week.
Okay, so I'll go first, obviously. So my obsession of the week, there's someone who I see on TikTok all the time. His TikTok handle is the musical dealer, and he's always recommending new cast recordings, different things that you can find in the musical theater world. And he recently recommended the all-female Jesus Christ Superstar cast recording.
Oh, and I feel like we've definitely not talked about this on air, but we've talked about this before, and I didn't know that it was out.
It just came out, I think, last month, and it sounds great. But the song that I am going to talk about is Superstar. And you know who's singing Superstar? Shoshana Bean. Shoshana Bean sings Superstar. And before I even listened to it, I was like, I'm obsessed. I'm obsessed. This is my obsession. Shoshana Bean singing Superstar. And I was right, because she sounds fantastic. The riffs are there. It's just a great song sung by a wonderful vocalist. There's no downsides. Don't you get it wrong now. Don't you get me wrong now.
Christ Superstar has gotten airtime in the last year. It's truly shocking. There's even when I don't even think we talked about this on the podcast, but when we saw Jake Epstein and they played,
yes, like 39 Lashes,
as instrumentally, like that was so, there's something about that music. And I said this before and I'll say it again, like maybe Andrew Lloyd Webber's greatest score of all time. I know The Phantom exists. And I know I've also given high praise to Joseph, but there is nothing like...
I think this is better than both of those. What about School of Rock? Superstar. I'm kidding.
I mean, we've talked about doing an ALW composer series because some of it truly wild. What's the other one? Starlight Express?
Yeah. Cats.
Yeah.
Cinderella. Cats. Bad Cinderella.
Yeah. Like, he's done so much, but this is really up there with, like... the best of the best. It's so good. Wow, I haven't listened to... I have to listen to
it's
it.
It's great. It's really great. It sounds wonderful. I love Shoshana.
Yeah.
Okay, what's your obsession?
Okay, my obsession this week, as I said, we are recording this episode on June 28th, and last night was the Jimmy Awards. Aww. Back in its full glory at the Minskoff Theater. And I just want to talk about what we've talked about in our Jimmy episode, which we released last year, so you can go listen to that. And it's the, like, Jason Robert Brown of it all. But before I get to him... yeah, it's so true. Before I get to him, my obsession this week is one of the soloists who... she was my winner, but she did not win. Sophie Polono, who sang The Music That Makes Me Dance from Funny Girl. And
well, like, an offbeat song choice a little bit.
A very offbeat song choice. I had to look it up to be like, is this from the movie or the musical? Because, like, I don't even remember where this song lands on a track listing. Her medley, which if you're going to watch the medleys, I think the Jimmy highlights will be on their YouTube page. But medley number 4 was my favorite. Everyone was going so hard. And she was playing Cinderella from Into the Woods. And she sang On the Steps of the Palace, which is a very hard song to sing, and nailed it. And then comes out and sings this song. And I feel she was robbed.
'Cause his is the only music that makes me dance. 'Cause his is the only music that makes me dance.
The other girl that won, Kendall, was amazing. She sang Breathe from In the Heights, which everyone knows, a song I love. But I feel like that's a song that I've heard before, and I haven't heard someone do this offbeat funny girl choice. So obsessed with Sophie. But let's talk about Jason Robert Brown, because in the 8 finalists, 4 people sang Jason Robert Brown. And we talked about this for like a full 10 minutes on our Jimmy episode of Jason Robert Brown and the Jimmy Awards.
So I haven't watched yet, but 2 of the boys sang Parade.
Yes.
One of them sang Bridges.
One of them sang Bridges, and then one girl also sang Parade.
Three and Parade.
My,
Yeah, what a downer for the parade. Kids, man. Not that Jason Robert Brown's writes happy things, but what a downer for the kids.
So two of the kids that sang Parade were part of the same, like, you know how you have to win, like, for your school?
Yeah.
They came from the same competition. So I saw many tweets being like, did they do this on purpose? Like, was this their way in to the finals?
Like, stand
out. And then I, like, shout out to Theater's Life on TikTok. We watch her all the time, but she was talking about this as well today and was like, imagine how many of the other kids had Jason Robert Brown in their back pocket for this.
I know we're always like, stop singing Jason Robert Brown, but it's clearly been successful, so why would they stop? It's working.
Okay, so ABF obviously sang Honeymoon in Vegas, which I had said to you today, this is like an offbeat Jason Robert Brown, yeah. So I'm fine with it, because no other kid is choosing I Love Betsy. Like, well, literally no other kid.
Wasn't he going to sing something else, and then he switched?
Probably.
I remember in like the doc or whatever, or the video, like Adam Cantor was like, don't sing the other one.
Right, and then Ethan Kelso won a few years ago, and he sang Wondering, but also that year someone sang It All Fades Away. So.
Yeah, It All Fades Away is too hard. It's too hard vocally, sorry.
And I'm tired of Wondering, so
I love Wondering, goodbye. But it's hard because this is about, like, a divorcee having an affair with a married woman, and these, like, 17-year-old, like, acne-ridden kids are, like, singing this intense song. Which is what acting is, but still.
No, it's so true. And then the winner this year, Nicholas Baran, sang This Is Not Over Yet from Parade. And I will say, he gave the best Parade solo, but it was also like, oh my God, Parade. And then Zach Schiffman, who, if you don't follow Zach Schiffman on Twitter, like, you really should. I got Steph following him because that's how funny he is. He tweeted being like, are all of these kids trying out to be Ben Platt's understudy for, like, the City Center performance? Because that's what it feels like. Mm. So now it makes me think, does Jason Robert Brown, like, invest in the Jimmys? Because also, the closing number was Stick Around from Mr. Saturday Night. Like, what?
Well, they always do, like, stuff from that year on Broadway, but it is funny that he
has so the opening number had every single song possible, including Diana, which was really exciting to me when they all started singing I Will.
I Will.
But yeah, they close it with, like, only Stick Around from Mr. Saturday Night. So when they're, like, putting up the sponsors, you know, thanks to this person, thanks to this person, Moulin Rouge, a sponsor this year. Yeah, I was like, wow, I can't believe we're getting this Jason Robert Brown song. Maybe his name was in the tiny list of sponsors and I just missed it.
I think the kids just love him. They think they're really smart and to, like, love Jason Robert Brown. They're like, I love him and no one else does, but everyone does.
Okay, but, like, if they are watching previous Jimmy Awards, aren't they like, oh, I've heard Wondering 10 times now. I'm not going to choose that.
But it hits. It works, okay?
It doesn't, because he lost. So
he was a finalist, though.
I'm over it. Sorry, JRB. I'm over it.
Never.
But with that being said, the Jimmys were lovely. It was so nice to see these kids come back. I always forget, because last year was the virtual Jimmys. And when the finalists, like, come up from the bottom of the stage at the Minscom, they're, like, on the toaster pop. It's so exciting. And also when they get to see their faces in Times Square, it's just, like, what an amazing event.
It's so nice. Time.
And to see that this many people have success, whether it be on Broadway or, like, national tours, so many kids are on national tours. Mm-hmm. It's really, like, what an amazing thing to exist. Actually, I was going to message you because Chris Sieber was there last night to introduce the Sondheim tribute.
Oh, wow.
And he was so emotional, being like, nothing existed like this when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And to think that these kids are here living out their dream on a Broadway stage, but also, like, making friendships that could potentially last them for the rest of their lives. It was like,
wow.
Love the Jimmys. Can't wait for next year.
No, anytime you see kids just, like, living their dream.
I know.
It's nice. It's nice.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So that's my obsession this week. Sophie Pollono and her performance from Funny Girl. I feel like we'll be seeing her name somewhere soon because she's ridiculous. And also just the Jimmys in general. And yeah, that's our thoughts also on Anne Juliet. Exciting. We're going to see Stratford, Chicago soon. So,
but if you're in Stratford on July 17th, like, let us know. Come say hi.
Yeah, we'll be in Stratford. And also Steph is going to New York, everybody.
I am. I'm going before company closes because I was very sad that I was gonna miss it. So I don't think I need show recommendations, but if anyone has like things to do recommendations, like let me
know. So you can expect some show reviews. Finally, I can't believe we're saying that again. We're seeing a lot and it's really exciting. So yeah, we cannot wait to see Anne Juliet again. And as I said, if you are in Toronto, if you are visiting Toronto for the summer, Anne Juliet is on stage until August 14th. Go see it. You won't regret it. And you can listen to any of our other episodes by subscribing to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also watch us on YouTube, where we'd really appreciate it if you subscribed and left us a comment.
And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Off2BeAwayPodcast. That's with the number 2. And if you guys saw Let Us and Juliet, let us know what you thought.
And we will see you guys next time.
Bye.